Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
For about 300 years, the burden of proof has been on us. You have to prove that it's true. And, you know, we'll just assume it's not until you prove that it is. And I wanted to let Christians know, no, I think I use the phrase, the consideration of the alternative. You know, if it isn't true, then how did it come to be?
I'm unconvinced that I live in a world where miracles happen. Therefore, because of that, when I read the Bible, I take the same attitude. I don't have a justification for miracles today. Therefore, I don't have a justification for miracles then.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there. Welcome along to today's show. Are the stories of Jesus uninvented is what we're asking. And I'll introduce my guests in just a moment's time. It's me, Justin, with you for the show that aims to get you thinking every weekend. And this is your final call for our live online show coming up this Tuesday, the 7th of February. It's on sexuality, gender and identity, as I'm joined by two same-sex attracted Christians, but with different perspectives on that. Andrew Bunt of Living Out, author of Finding Your Best Identity, is opposite Charlie Bell, author of Queer Holiness. You can be part of the live audience by registering at unbelievable.live. So that's going to be happening this Tuesday, the 7th of February. It'll be 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific if you're out in the States. But you can join live simply by registering at unbelievable.live. Now, if you want more from the show, of course, you can find everything you need at premierunbelievable.com, podcasts, articles, resources. And while there, register for our newsletter. When you do that, we'll send you a free ebook by William Lane Craig, God's Not Dead, laying out the evidence for God's existence. Again, premierunbelievable.com to register for our newsletter and see all of our podcast articles and resources. Towards the end of today's show, some feedback on last week's miracle healing debate. Gosh, lots of response to that one. And I'll tell you about some of the exciting shows lining up for the rest of February too. Hope you enjoy today's discussion. Well, today on the show, we're talking about whether the stories of Jesus are too scandalous to have been made up. Uninvented, Why the Bible Could Not Be Made Up and the Evidence That Proves It is the title of a new book by apologist Mike DiVirgilio. Mike's contention is that despite the modern criticism of the historicity of the Bible, the scriptures themselves actually contain the evidence that they're true, because the stories don't read like the made-up stories, myths and legends that the critics claim. The authors simply wouldn't have had the motivations to invent the stories in the way they tell them. Well, testing Mike's conclusions today is a friend of the show, Matthew Taylor, who runs the Still Unbelievable podcast. Matthew himself is an ex-Christian, and while he believes there is a historic element to the person of Jesus, he believes that many stories and details that you find in the Gospels are essentially the result of pious fiction on the part of later authors. So in a nutshell, is it true that you can't make this stuff up, or is it actually a lot of it fiction when it comes to the stories of Jesus? So that's our subject on the show today. Looking forward to this one. We'll come to you, Mike, to hear a bit more about the book in a moment. But first of all, Matthew, welcome to the show. Have you been on the show before, Matthew? I feel like you have.
No, this is the first time. We have met, though, when you signed my copy of your book when you released it at the Unbelievable conference.
But this is I feel like we've known each other a long time.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, Justin.
I think that part of the reason I feel like I know you quite well, Matthew, is because you and friends of yours, you know, have sort of been in the orbit of Unbelievable for well over a decade, I would think, if not more.
For a very, very long time.
Comes to the show,
yes.
And yeah, And it's been lovely in a sense to have that kind of symbiosis of the different projects we run and your podcast. I know you guys sort of edited a book together when my book came out, a kind of response book. So I thought of you when it came to this, because Mike is a sort of lay person in this area. And I thought, well, actually, Matthew's a well-read and interesting and lay person in this area, too. So tell us a bit about your backstory, though. I did read out an email just towards the end of last year that you sent through in response to one of our shows on colonialism and Africa and so on. And your story sort of begins, doesn't it, in Africa?
It does, yes. I'm quite opinionated on that colonialism and missionary work in Zambia, but obviously that is not in the remit of this show. But firstly, I feel like I need to invest in some new background because there's not enough books behind me. So that's clearly something that I need to correct.
We're winning on the book front. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But anyway, yes, what's your story, Matthew?
So thank you, Justin, and thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation. It's impossible to engage on social media and the interaction between atheism as a religion without coming across your podcast. And if there is a single podcast that everybody wants to be on or a host to have as a guest, then Unbelievable and you, Justin, are the show and the person who that description applies to.
Well, yeah, so that's incredibly generous of you. And I will pay you that £10 note later. Yes,
I feel like it's a life achievement that's happening now. But my backstory is actually quite long, and so I need to try and keep it as short as I can here. But I would like to do a plug. If anybody does want the longer version of my backstory, then I have appeared on the Graceful Atheist podcast. So go through the back catalogue of that and you'll find the episode where I'm talking about my story in much greater detail. But I was brought up as a Christian in the missionary environment in Zambia during the 70s and 80s. My mum comes from a family of multiple generations of missionaries, some of whom are still active in Zambia. So the Christianity that I was indoctrinated into as a young child in that environment was a very fundamentalist Christianity. So that taught me to do things like reject evolution as an idea and to be fearful of people like myself, people who are atheists. So that was the kind of picture and the structure of the Christianity that I was brought up into. So at 18, I left Zambia, came to the UK, got married in my 20s, and eventually during the process of living as an adult, got a greater understanding of the scientific process. And that was into my 30s when I started to doubt Christianity and the Christianity that I'd been brought into. And it was at that point when, during my questioning and my deconstructing is a buzzword now that we use to describe that process, that I came across podcasting, and podcasts were still relatively new there. And I very quickly found your show, Justin, among a variety of other Christian podcasts. And over the period of doubting that followed, many of those podcasts that I listened to then came and went. But yours has been the one fixed podcast that has lasted the period. In fact, I make a joke, Justin, that yours is the only religious podcast that I listen to religiously. And yes, it's intended as a joke, but it is actually true. I do listen to your podcast. In terms of historicity, I started listening to your podcast around about the time that you were doing the atheist prayer experiment. But when I started listening, I started at the beginning. So by the time I got to the prayer experiment episodes, the experiment was over. So my opportunity to even consider being involved in that simply didn't happen. So that and then time went by. I continued to listen to your podcast. And then at 10 years, you announced that you're going to write a book about that. Actually, let me just quickly stop and rewind a bit. What I had hoped from your podcast was that it would save my Christianity, because my Christianity was struggling at that time. My Christianity was struggling deeply under the weight of the scientific knowledge that I had and the challenges that I had in terms of intellectually holding on to my faith. And I thought, great, this is a podcast where there are skeptics and Christians in dialogue and in conversation. This, if anything is going to save my faith, this is the podcast that's going to do it for me. And I found that the longer I listened and the more that I listened, I found that it didn't do that for me. It didn't save my faith. And I know that you've had letters from listeners, Justin, who have given the opposite testimony, but mine is one that it didn't save my faith. And instead, I found myself getting further and further away from Christianity. And then we got to the point where at 10 years in, you announced your book. And I thought, oh, it would be quite interesting to write a rebuttal to some of the arguments in this book, because by that time, I was out. I'm still engaging with Christian arguments, which is why I'm here today. But my Christian journey was effectively at an end by that point. And so various other people also had the same idea, and we all banded together and we did the book Still Unbelievable. That came out shortly after your book, and David and Andrew were on Unbelievable talking about it when that came out. And then about a year later, somebody thought it was going to be a good idea to launch a podcast of the same name. And I think it was David over at Skeptics and Seekers who said, Matthew, I think you'll be a good voice for Still Unbelievable. And it was not on my radar to be involved in Still Unbelievable at all, not the podcast anyway. It really wasn't there. But I got dragged into it because somebody thought it was a good idea. And frankly, I've loved it. It's been about 4 years now we've been doing Still Unbelievable. I've had some fascinating and lovely conversations with people I never expected that I'll have conversations with. And I've really appreciated that. I've been challenged in ways that I never thought I would be challenged by. But ultimately, it hasn't changed my view of Christianity. I still find it unbelievable. And here I am having this conversation with you.
Well, thank you for coming back and having the conversation. I should say I'm due to come on your show in the near future. I'm not sure whether that episode will drop before or after this.
No, this episode will be out by the time I've edited our conversation. But I'm looking forward to that. And thank you for agreeing to come into the bear pit that is sometimes still unbelievable. We'll treat you nice, though.
I'm looking forward to it, and thanks for thank you very much. Well, look, looking forward to that. I'll make sure, of course, there's a link to where people can find the podcast and more about you. But thanks for coming on the show today, Matthew. Mike, let's meet you as well. I have struggled, as we've communicated, to know exactly how to pronounce your surname, but I can say it is Mike De Virgilio. And we won't go into the background to your interesting name, but tell us a bit about you, Mike, your story, and why you wrote this particular book, Uninvented.
Yeah, well, as Italian, De Virgilio, grew up Catholic and went away to college, it seems like 100 years ago now, to Arizona State University. This was in the late 70s, and I became what we called at the time a born-again Christian. And it was sort of like Matthew was saying, sort of a fundamentalist type of Christianity, me and the Bible, and that was about it. And the key thing there is the only reason I decided to become a Christian was because I believed it was true, it was real. And if this God is actually there, I'm all in. And then a couple years later, I came across Francis Schaeffer's The God Who Is There. And a lot of your listeners would be familiar with Schaeffer. And that was my introduction into apologetics. And I was delighted to find that there was a lot of evidence for the veracity of Christianity, rational, logical reasons. And so I got into apologetics and learned about it. And a handful of years later, I went off to a seminary, to Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, and met my wife there, and was never going to be a minister, but I thought I might go into academia, and we got married and decided against that, wasn't going to work. So just made a living, had three children, and so on. And then how the book came about is in 2009, I had an encounter with a coworker of mine and realized that I hadn't really read any apologetics for years, actually a couple of decades, and my apologetics chops were horrible. I mean, it was embarrassing. He wouldn't have known it was embarrassing, but to me it was embarrassing. And so I said, boom, and I got a car with an auxiliary cable and started to listening to podcasts, and I was thrilled about the explosion of apologetics resources that had happened in the last two decades, including Unbelievable Podcasts, which is, I'm sure, one of the first ones I started listening to, and just inundated myself. And then I hope I got somewhat better at doing apologetics. But it was 2015 May. I read an article by a young woman, grew up in a Christian home, dedicated Christian. So she goes off to college and almost immediately abandons her faith and becomes an agnostic. And it ticked me off because I said, you know, that would never happen to my children. Because I taught them what, you know, it was for us, is that we believe this just because this is true. We don't believe it just because we want to or it makes us feel better or whatever. And so I decided I was going to write a blog post because I'd written for blog posts for years. And so I'm going to write a book. See how the heck I did that. And so I wrote a book called The Persuasive Christian Parent, How to Build an Enduring Faith in You and Your Children. And in the study for that book, I came across this idea that the Bible and the stories, et cetera, couldn't be made up. And it was amazing how consistent it was. But most Christians don't really know that, because our tendency is to believe, you know, it, of course, conservative Christians, it's not made up. You know, why would we believe it? But it could be, yeah, maybe. And so I initially was going to call the book Psychological Apologetics, which nobody would have known what the heck that meant. But to me, the psychology of the people in the stories just appeared. So I use the word in the book a lot, verisimilitude, just appears real. They appear like, you know, the tendency, I think you use the phrase myths and fairy tales. And so that's what the skeptics and so on tend to think it is. But it doesn't read that way at all. I mean, the people in the Bible are as freaked out about the stuff they encounter there as you and I would be. It's not like, well, they're ancient people and so they believe in miracles. No, people just don't walk on water, for instance, or come back from the dead. You know, people don't get healed because they touch somebody or whatever. So, obviously changed the name to Uninvented. But the target audience was primarily Christians because of what I just said. You know, I just, for what, 300 years, the burden of proof has been on us. You know, you have to prove that it's true. And, you know, we'll just assume it's not until you prove that it is. And I wanted to let Christians know, no, I think I use the phrase, the consideration of the alternative. You know, if it isn't true, then how did it come to be?
Yeah, I one of the people you quote is, I think, C.S. Lewis. Now, I don't have the quote to hand, but he talks about, I think, at one point in one of his books, that he, having looked and known, you know, being an expert in ancient literature and mythology, he said these accounts, the Gospels, when he came to them as an adult, they didn't have that feel. They didn't feel like the same kind of mythology and fables of ancient literature. I mean, what are some of the kind of, and obviously Matthew will have a chance to respond to a lot of this, but just in general in the book, what are kind of some of the historical clues that you were pinpointing that for you say, no, this has the ring of truth. It doesn't feel like this is the kind of thing people would have made up, or just feels legendary or mythological in that sense.
The most important thing I would want readers to take away, and what I learned, is that a Jewish Jesus would be, in my opinion, impossible to invent. You know, so for 300 years of biblical criticism, my first chapter, I go into a very brief history of biblical criticism, and Enlightenment assumptions that miracles can't really happen were just assumed. You know, I call it question begging anti-supernatural bias. It's just that, so they had to be, these stories had to come from somewhere, and the idea tended to be that there was a little kernel of history there, because there's very few people that say Jesus didn't exist, but there was a kernel of history, and then over time, the stories developed basically in Gentile pagan environments, and the stories, you know, like the telephone game, you'd say it first, and then over time, it just changes and changes and changes. Well, in the 70s, finally, the Jewish nature of Jesus' world became apparent to the whole world of biblical criticism, and that just lended more credibility to the stories. And we get into details of why Jesus as the Messiah was the most unexpected Messiah. He was inconceivable to Jews because there was nothing. I mean, I quote a Jewish historian named Giza Vermes, who talked about the virgin birth, talked about the crucifixion and resurrection. There was no thought or idea or anything in literature about, you know, a virgin being born, God becoming man, Yahweh becoming man, or what a resurrection, or the Messiah dying for the sins and atoning for the sins. It just doesn't there. Now, he didn't buy it because he's Jewish, but where did those things come from?
And this is what a lot of the book hinges on is the sense of what what motivation could someone have had to invent this kind of a Jesus? It doesn't feel like, you know, someone wanting to rally people to a Jewish cause would have created this kind of a Messiah. There's sometimes, you know, it's been talked about in the world of apologetics, this criterion of embarrassment historically. And that applies to things like, for instance, when it comes to the resurrection, the fact that women are the first discoverers of the empty tomb. And people have often said that, that, you know, the fact that a woman's testimony was worth less in that world shows that it now has this kind of historical credibility. You wouldn't have invented that if you were trying to persuade people of a falsehood and so on. So it feels like there's a lot of that kind of historical work going on in this book, Mike. It all sort of seems to center around that whole idea of, look, you wouldn't make this stuff up. If you were trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes or invent a kind of popular movement in that day and age and that place, this wouldn't have been the way you went about it. Therefore, it feels like they were actually telling the truth.
It's the opposite. Jesus does everything he can to say, I don't want you to follow me. I mean, the stuff he says is so radical and so un-Jewish. Like, he says, eat my flesh. It's real food. You drink my blood, which if you drank Moses in Deuteronomy, I forget somewhere, says, don't drink blood. Do not do this. And here is a guy claiming to be the Messiah saying, drink my blood. Or come and follow me and take up your cross. Really? Okay, the most horrific means of torture. So disgusting that pagans didn't even want to talk about it. It was horrible. But he says, that's what you need to do if you want to follow me. Take up your instrument of torture. I mean, my mother would always say about this Jewish friend of hers that Jesus was the greatest salesman ever. And I say, Mom, he was a horrible salesman. He was not about how to win friends and influence people at all. You know, he says, hate your family. You know, well, wait a second. The family is the most important thing to a Jewish, you know, person in the first century. What do you mean hate them? Love your enemies? Well, wait a second. How can I love my enemies but hate my family? You know, I just don't see how this inconceivable stuff gets invented in a person's brain just for the heck of it.
Please come in, Matthew. I was going to say, high time we brought you in. First of all, I suppose, general thoughts on the book if you want to respond to some of the specifics there.
General thoughts on the book. Mike answered my first question earlier, was who is the target audience of this book? Because reading through the book, I didn't feel like I was the target audience for this book. You know, if this book was meant to get people like me back into the kingdom, it wasn't going to do it for me. There's not enough meat in there to get me back into my state of belief, because my deconstruction involved years of me battling with some of the concepts that this book deals with. And I had to get to a point of from belief to not only non-belief, but active rejection on some of these points, specifically the miracles. So for me to get back the other way again, it needs something more and something much more fundamental and something with much more gravitas than this book offers to an individual like myself. So the very first question I wanted to ask Mike was, who's the target audience for this book? Because I don't feel like I am, and I think Mike's already answered that. So what did I make of the book? Well, if it's a book that's not going to get me seriously considering Christianity again, because the points that it brings up and the arguments that it brings are arguments that I've already handled, I've already dealt with, already agonized over for extended periods of time and got to the point where these won't get me. I need something that compels me to believe, something evidential that I have no option but to be compelled. And an argument doesn't do that to me, because I can deny an argument. I need something fundamentally evidential that's impossible for me to deny. So that's the distinction I would make in terms of what the book says. And there's other parts of the book where I have problems, because they gave me flashbacks to my old Christianity, which for me were unhelpful to read. And some of them is there's a repeated phrase quite often in the book of the only way a skeptic person is going to be skeptical of the Bible is to come at it with an anti-supernatural bias. And that's absolutely not the kind of position that I have. So reading that multiple times through the book was problematic for me because it doesn't describe my position. And it certainly doesn't describe the position of many of the atheists that I know and interact with daily. So again, for that people in that camp, the deconstructed, reading things like that is actually going to be a problem for them to read it.
Any thoughts on that, Mike?
So, the anti-supernatural bias is something that comes historically in the Enlightenment. That there was a rejection of, in fact, Thomas Jefferson famously cut out all the supernatural bits and made his own Jefferson Bible. And so, to me, that's justified. Well, you know, I unfortunately don't have a lot of conversations with atheists, ex-Christians. I would love to engage. It probably can't happen here in any depth in less than an hour, you know, about, you know, what, so how do you, okay, how do you come to something that is miraculous, like Jesus walking on water, stilling the storm, just to pick two examples?
Good question, very valid question. And yeah, that, it's exactly that kind of thing that I had to battle with when I was deconstructing. And how do I approach those kinds of passages? And the first question I would ask myself is, what is the basis on which I would believe this? Or what was the basis on which I did believe it when I did believe it? And the only reason I had for believing it as a Christian was that it says so in the Bible. That was literally the only possibility I had of believing it. So when you start doubting things in the Bible...
What would the other possibility be?
We mean that it didn't happen.
Well, you said the only reason you believed it is because it's in the Bible.
Yeah.
What would there be any other thing to convince you that it's not in the Bible?
I can't imagine. I can't imagine there being any other reason for believing it other than choosing to believe what the Bible says is actually and literally true. So that is basically the fundamental point at which a lot of this kind of conversation rests. And can I trust the Bible when it says a passage like that about Jesus walking on the water and calming the storm and then fetching Peter out of the, it was Peter, wasn't it, out of the boat, and he too walks on the water and then loses his faith and all that. And it's, you can imagine it would be quite a traumatic experience to be in if it happened. And so the bottom line question is, on what basis could I believe this happened? And the only basis is it says so in the Bible. And so part of deconstruction is challenging and reading those passages in the Bible and thinking, okay, is there a way outside of the Bible in which I could validate this kind of experience as being possible? Not necessarily that experience being true, but at least being possible. Because if I can establish a case for that kind of scenario being possible, then I'm on the road to believing that maybe it happened for true. And I can't even get to there. You know, there's no repeatable position in which somebody walking on water happens. You know, I can't pray to God and walk on water. So if I can't do that, why should I believe the Bible did it?
Right. So, okay, so let's say I offended atheists with the word bias, okay? Yeah. So what do you call that? You don't, you're saying to me that that can't happen,
yeah,
because people don't walk on water, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's a begging the question issue that I quote Lewis about that, because you have to get the philosophical. He says, Lewis says in Miracles, you have to get the philosophical issue first. You deal with that. Can miracles happen? If they can't, as he says, you know, you're just wasting time going to the text. And I think I put in there, there's been a lot of time wasting over the last 300 years because people just assume philosophically they miracles can't happen. And I agree,
yeah,
with you. If I didn't believe human beings could walk on water and I read that, I would say that's silly.
Yeah, sure.
But how do you not call that a bias?
But certainly in a naturalistic world, miracles don't happen and it's not normal to expect miracles to happen. So if we had a scenario where miracles did happen, whether it was ad hoc or regularly, then we have a scenario where a miraculous event is shown to have happened. And therefore, that gives you ground to say, okay, if we're in a world where miraculous events are seen to have happened, then now I'm in a position where I can go back to the Bible and read those miracles as they're possible. But I don't live in a world where I can see that miracles have happened. You know, I've done a couple of shows on Still Unbelievable about miracles. Brian Blaze, who you've had on your own show once or twice, Justin, has also been on Still Unbelievable a couple of times. And we did very recently, only a few episodes back, a show on miracles. And we talked about miracles. And usually these kind of conversations revolve around people having a miraculous healing. And we talked them through and we talked about around a couple of examples where people have tried to scientifically establish a case for miracles having happened. One of the most famous ones, I think, is people being allegedly healed of hearing or eyesight issues in Mozambique in the 70s. I think you had that one discussed in one of your shows, Justin, and we talked about that one. And the scientific study that is allegedly done around this case is actually really, really poor. And there is no criteria in which we can actually justifiably believe some of the things that they're saying. So they get rejected. And this happens time and time again when you look into the nitty-gritty of miracle claims. So I'm unconvinced that I live in a world where miracles happen. And because the miracle claims don't survive the test. Therefore, because of that, when I read the Bible, I take the same attitude. I don't have a justification for miracles today. Therefore, I don't have a justification for miracles then.
Yeah. Quick response from you, Mike, and we'll go to a break. And just on the subject of miracles, one of our by the time this show lands, I think it will have gone out, actually, we're doing another show on that very specific issue of scientific evidence for miracles. So it's all very relevant.
That'll be but interesting.
Mike, quick response, and we'll
I do have a quick response, is that the people in the boat and the people around Jesus react exactly the way you would if you were there. This can't happen. This just can't happen. So that's why it has a psychological verisimilitude, because how do people, I mean, there is no such thing as fiction. How do people make up stories that read so real? Like people like you, if you were on the boat, they think they saw a ghost. This can't happen.
All the best stories read like they're real.
Precedents and, well, exactly. That's verisimilitude. But these don't read like stories because they read like history. Right. And that's why there's we'll come to that,
because we're going to dig in the rest of the show to some specific areas of Jesus's life. We've talked a bit about miracles at this point, but his life, was it too unconventional to be made up? That's sort of one of the claims of your book, Mike. Jesus's crucifixion, was it too scandalous to have been made up? And Jesus's resurrection, was it too unexpected to have been made up? We're going to try and get to all three of those anyway in the course of the show. My guests today are Mike DiVirgilio and also Matthew Taylor. We're talking about whether the stories of Jesus are too scandalous, too unexpected, too unusual to have been made up. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're talking about the book Uninvented, Why the Bible Could Not Be Made Up and the Evidence That Proves It. It's a new book by apologist Mike DiVirgilio. There's a link to Mike's website where you can find out more about this book. But essentially at the core of it, it's the idea, well, you couldn't make this stuff up, especially the character of Jesus. Too unique, too unusual, too scandalous, too out of, you know, out of historical context to be able to kind of suddenly just be made up as this character of fiction almost. So as I said before, Matthew and Mike, we want to dig into this in some specific ways. Why don't we start with you, Mike, just making the case for why you think Jesus's life was too unconventional to be made up. Talk a bit about, you know, his personal background, the company he kept and that kind of thing, that just for you gives this the sense that this is historically authentic, not the kind of thing someone would have tried to invent at the time.
Yeah. So we were talking about miracles, and even if you look apart from the miracles, Jesus would have been very difficult to invent, because every cultural expectation of the day he seemed to contradict. He was a conundrum is the word I use, and he was just confusing. And you know, the in terms of even his own personality, because I talk about a movie from the, well, it's actually a miniseries called Jesus of Nazareth, which is our favorite Jesus movie. And he seemed to be a great conundrum Jesus, because everybody, he would say things and they're like, what? Where did that come from? You know, he calls, for example, he says Peter's the rock. And then in the next scene, Peter says, you're not going to go die. No. And he calls him Satan. You're just like, this is bizarre. And that gets to the criterion of embarrassment, because the disciples are clueless. And he says stuff and they just like, or like the stuff he says, his teaching. So I have a chapter on Jesus' teaching. He says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. And I'm expected to believe a Jew. First of all, if he said that and it wasn't true, he was going to be stoned as a blasphemer, right? Because he says, you've seen me. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So we have two options there. So either he said that and it wasn't true, so he's a liar, or he's a megalomaniac, you know, the Lord lunatic liar thing that C.S. Lewis made famous. Or a Jew at the time put it in his mouth. Well, a Jew wouldn't do that. Now, would a pagan later, in 100 years later, write that in? Well, most scholars believe that the Bible text actually comes from the first century, written by Jews now. But so it's just stuff like that. I mean, we could go through many examples, but he was just confusing to people.
It's interesting you mentioned, again, just before we come back to you, Matthew, the criterion of embarrassment in regards to that story about Peter. And you could also possibly tie it to the story of Peter trying to walk on water and failing. Are you saying that there's a kind of sense in which the leaders of a movement, and Peter was obviously the leader of this movement, you wouldn't invent stories that made the leader look bad? And these are what these stories effectively do. They do cast Peter as a bit of a bumbling, you know, gets it wrong quite often. And you'd have no, this wouldn't be the way that a movement that was essentially predicated on pulling the wool over people's eyes would have tried to, you know, sort of paint their movement in that way.
Yeah, impetuous Peter. And it's interesting because this theme goes throughout the Bible. So it's not just that the Gospels make the key players look bad, but all through the Bible, you know, this idea of those who believe in Yahweh in the Old Testament just come off looking like, well, David is a great example, you know. So because this applies, this whole idea of uninvented applies through all the Bible, because look at David. He's a man after God's own heart, and yet he commits adultery, has the husband killed. Do you make up a story about the one in whom Christ would be in the lineage? And so... and it applies in spades to me in the Gospels. They just do not make them look good.
Okay. Matthew, some responses to these sorts of points.
Yeah, I don't understand why the embarrassment criterion is so attractive to Christians, if I'm really, truly honest. It's probably one of the greatest tropes in fictional narratives. You pick any big blockbuster movie, Days of Thunder, Die Hard, Harry Potter, any of those big movies, the hero always has a dip. There's always that dip of confidence. There's always that silly thing that's done. There's always that moment of failure. And part of the story of the greatest heroes is them overcoming a moment of weakness, a moment of failure, a moment of embarrassment, as it were. And they overcome that. They get past it. Even all the Rocky movies have it, for goodness sake. So I genuinely don't get why this is embraced so heartily by Christians, because it literally is probably the oldest and most long-lived and most used fictional trope for creating somebody who's a hero.
Trope. So you said fictional several times.
Yeah.
Fiction didn't really exist in the ancient world. I mean, so... if you read
the Gospels, understand why you would say that.
Well, because modern fiction, most people say modern fiction really started, and there's different people, you know, different periods, but maybe the 17th, 16th century, Mary Shelley, you know, in the early parts of the 19th century with the Frankenstein or whatever. So when you read the Bible, you know, a non-Christian would not agree with me, but the stories are told so well and so believably, for me, from my perspective, and most obviously Christian's perspective, it would have to be a genius fix to me, a genius fiction writer who did this, who made people appear so real and did it so well.
Are you saying they would have had to invent the genre of modern fiction in the first century, and which then got actually reinvented in the 16th, 17th century? You're saying it just doesn't, that kind of writing, fictional writing, didn't exist back then, Mike. Is that what
right? And it's not even the way the stories are told are done so expertly and so well and have stood the test of time. So I know it doesn't persuade Matthew, right, and other non-Christians, which is fine, right? But it has persuaded people for thousands of years. And like Augustine was embarrassed. You know, he was a 5th century bishop. He was a rhetorician. He was, you know, going to teach Caesar and all this stuff. And he was embarrassed by the Bible because it was just so simple, especially the Old Testament, simplistic. And then conversion, he dives in and it's, you know, genius. And then, and skeptics have been trying to tear it apart for a long time and they can't do
Matthew?
It.
Matthew?
I'm confused by this line of reasoning, to be honest. When I went and Googled, when I went and did an internet search on Jewish history, I came across something called The Exegogue of Ezekiel, which is apparently a Jewish fictional narrative based on the Exodus story. So we've got a fictional story written there based on previous stories, and that gets into a separate subject on whether or not the Exodus is fiction or not, but we've still got a fictional narrative of a well-known story. And then if you look at other things, we've got the Epic of Gilgamesh, again a fictional story. You go and look at some of the Greek gods of a similar sort of time. You've got Osiris, who turned at a wedding, turned a lake of water into wine. And you've got all sorts of other gods who did amazing and crazy things, some of which sound similar to events in Jesus' life. But these are all fictional accounts. These are all things that we look back and accept as fictional. No, they're not modern fiction by any standard. But then Jesus isn't modern fiction either. So I don't understand what this line of reasoning is trying to achieve, because there is plenty of examples of fiction in ancient literature. But let's say, for example, that Mike is right and Jesus is the first example of this kind of narrative writing. That doesn't equal true. That just means someone came up with the idea. Because in anything that's fictional, there's always going to be the person who wrote down that trope first. That's always going to be the case, regardless of how popular that fiction is. It's always going to be a first occurrence. And so what if Jesus is the first occurrence of this kind of writing? That doesn't make it true.
Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, well, there's two things that I think we have to deal with. I disagree, but we don't have time to really flesh all that out. But after I deal in the first chapter with what I believe is a bias for naturalism, I talk about the Christian concept of revelation, right? So I told somebody this recently, is basically we have warring assumptions, okay? The naturalist, the tendency of skeptics and atheists is to think they're rational and logical, and they only follow the evidence and where it goes, but that's not true. Because we all have assumptions. We all come to something with predetermined ideas. So I have two that are fundamental. One is that the idea, first, God's a possibility. I believe in him. So the idea of biblical revelation, the idea of revelation from God is a possibility, right? And the Bible says he revealed himself in creation. He revealed himself in Scripture and in Christ. So I assume God can reveal himself. And the third chapter, I talk about biblical inspiration. And the claims, here's the difference between Gilgamesh and all of the ancient things. The Bible claims to be the very words of the living creator God. And he spoke those words through men and did it by the Holy Spirit. So I have I've never had a problem with that. And so when you say, I just read it in the Bible because that's the only reason I believe it's true. Exactly. Exactly, because I believe, I come to it with an assumption, a presupposition, that it is God's revealed word through men.
But I get the sense as well, before Matthew comes back, Mike, that you're also appealing to people who may not share your assumptions and saying, but if you were to compare, for instance, the stories of Jesus to other equivalent ancient literature of the time,
right,
it stands out. It's different. It doesn't feel like this is the kind of fictional accounts that Matthew says were swimming around in the ancient world of gods and miracles and you know, Osiris and everything else.
And it was written to Jews. It was written to Jews and by Jews.
Right. So I just want to get that clear, that it's not that you're expecting for your argument to carry for people to have the same assumptions about that God can, you know, it's that you're saying there's a historical clue here that should make you question your own assumptions about whether this could, you know,
right,
miracles could happen and be reported and Jesus really was who he claimed to be and so on.
Yeah, is it even possible? So if God is there, just posit God. Is it possible that this could happen? And one of the things I was going to say is that the last several years, I've listened to hundreds of testimonies of people who've become Christians. And every one of them goes to the Bible, well, almost all of them, they go to the Bible and it's not what they expect. They don't go in with assumptions, but they go in seeking, could this be true? And, you know, and literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these things I've listened to. And it's amazing how the power of the Bible, a French atheist, I forget his name, he was like, that's not the Jesus I was presented with in the secular culture. I mean, this Jesus is manly. This Jesus is in your face. This Jesus is different, right? And going back to fiction, to have four different authors, you know, and to make up Jesus, and it's, anyway, you could go down that rabbit hole forever, but it's so amazing who they made up if they made him up. It's Tom Holland. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, quick response, and then we'll move on to our next aspect of Jesus.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think probably the point I would want to make most is if the Bible truly was as special as Mike would have me believe, I would expect the historical transmission of the Bible to look different to other ancient texts. Because when we look at ancient texts, we see additions into ancient texts. We see over time as texts get copied, I'm basically talking about textual criticism and stuff like that. And we can trace changes through ancient copies of texts, and we can see how they've changed over years. And when you look at tiny fragments, and then we look at broader pieces that are written hundreds of years later, you can see that there are differences that creep into the manual copying of these things until we get to the printing press, and then things change dramatically forever. And every ancient text, we have this kind of thing, and we kind of see the same kinds of patterns of human copying and human errors creeping in over time. And the Bible texts meet exactly that kind of criteria. They don't stand out as being different. They don't stand out as having any kind of supernatural assistance in the transmission and the copying over years. They look just like every other human created text. Now, I'm not talking about the truth of the content. I'm just talking about the accuracy of the transmission. And it looks just the same. The historical transmission of the Bible looks just the same as every other human created document.
So are you saying that for it to be true, for you to take it seriously or to believe it has a divine sort of stamp, Matthew, it would not only have to be true in the content, the original content as well, but God would have to have had that somehow hermetically sealed from historical processes in a way that other...
Yeah, I don't know how I would be able to determine if it was God or not, but I would expect that the transmission history of the Bible to stand out as being different to every other human creation, and it doesn't.
Is that a fair kind of level that Matthew's demanding there, Mike, of how the Bible should have been transmitted to us to today?
I don't know what he means, but I have an example that blew my mind that I didn't know about till I was actually studying for my first book. There's the oldest, prior to the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest manuscript of the Book of Isaiah was from the Masoretes, Masoretic text in the 9 to 1,000, somewhere up there. And when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was 200 BC, they found a complete text of Isaiah, and it was exactly like the text 1,000 plus years later. So what that told me was that the ability for scribes to accurately, I mean, leaving God out of it right now, accurately take and transmit text to text, because that's all they could do, right? They took it very seriously, and it worked. And then I add God in there, because he's God.
But this is a text that you refer to in chapter 2 of your book. And I was able to fact check, because that was one of the claims you make in the book that I found was the easiest to fact check. So I went and did that, and I did some checking about the scrolls. And what I found other things which you don't mention in the chapter. It's not just the one copy of Isaiah. There are multiple copies of Isaiah that were found, and they weren't identical with each other. There were changes between them. They found differences in the text. So between these multiple copies of the text, there were differences. There were insertions in the margins of the comments. So they were able to identify multiple authors. They were able to identify insertions into the text which changed the text that was being said between one copy and another. So this claim of exact copy is, I'm going to actually call that out and say that's probably false, because there are multiple copies and they weren't identical. And there, like I say, there were evidence of changes in transmission over time.
Right, but nobody says, even the greatest I'm not a textual critic, I'm not a scholar, but even they have, these scholars, Christian scholars, have taken everything that the critics have said about textual transmission, and I find their arguments persuasive, and we can't flesh that out here. But there's plenty of scholars, Christian scholars, who've made the case that we can trust the text, as opposed to what Richard Dawkins says, that it's all, or other atheists.
But how can you trust something, though, that changes over time?
Well, I suppose the question is, Matthew, whether you can bring the original text back to the surface, as it were, through the science of textual criticism. And I don't think any historical scholar, even of, you know, fully evangelical stripes, are questioning it does change.
Right.
The question is, can you recover the original text through textual criticism? And like Mike, I've heard lots of people who say, well, you can basically get back to sort of 99% what the original manuscript said.
Yeah, I accept you can quite accurately get back to what the original text says, but that doesn't answer the question of, did what the original text say comport to the truth?
Now we're talking about two different things again, right?
That's a separate thing, I suppose. I mean, let's talk about then, just to move this along a little bit, you know, what is, you know, generally in historical terms perceived to be one of the you know, the best attested events of ancient history, Jesus' crucifixion. That's a fairly uncontroversial thing to say. Now, the resurrection is perhaps a different matter, but let's stick with the crucifixion for now. Too scandalous to be made up. Make your case for this, Mike, and let's see what Matthew has to say.
Well, where did the... First of all, we have to go back to the unexpected Messiah, right? So I find Matthew's arguments not persuasive to me, because this Messiah would have to have been invented. Just had to have been, because he's not real. Right? He's a fictional character for the most part. I don't know what degree you might say, Matthew, it's 80% or 10 or whatever. It doesn't matter. That the Messiah was the most expected thing in all of the Jewish world in the first century, because in Malachi at the end of the early 400s BC, Bible stops. I mean, the Old Testament just stops. And there's this promise, you know, somebody to come. And for hundreds of years, it was, this is him, this is him. And then John comes, this is him. He's, no, I'm not it. And then we find out that it's Jesus. So, and there was conflicting ideas about who this Messiah would be, as I talk about in the book. But zero people expected the Messiah that Jesus was. And to me, to make up Jesus, his personality, his teaching, you know, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard that it was said, referring somewhat to the Pharisees and the authoritative, but I say to you, you know, he's basically saying, I'm the guy. I'm the authoritative. And
how does this particularly sort of come into focus with the crucifixion?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why is that in particular not the kind of Messiah that you think Jews of the time would have invented?
So I quote Giza Vermes, who's the Jewish historian. He says nobody at the time expected a Messiah to die for people's sins. Nobody. And so where does that come from? This idea of making up and then making a Messiah. And this is taking there's an apologetics called a cumulative case argument. If you take everything into account, you can maybe tear apart one thing I say or this or whatever. But when you take the cumulative case, and I think the biggest thing for me is that anybody who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. It's in Deuteronomy. So we have to believe that they made up a Messiah, whether it was after the fact. Let's say he died and they stole the body. And they said, yeah, we're going to turn this Jesus guy. We know he wasn't the Messiah. We're going to make him up to be one. And that he died on a Roman cross. And that's a good thing. The reason they were so freaked out afterwards and depressed is because he was under God's curse. There was no Messiah. There was no conception that a Messiah would do that and die, be the curse for us. And it's, you know, theological genius when you look back at it, that he paid the price, the promise in Genesis 3:15, right? That he would strike his heel, and it's all there. And yet it took Jesus rising from the dead to get him to believe it, to say the Old Testament's about me, Luke 24.
And just before we come to Matthew's response, something else that I think you were about to mention this in the last part of the show, but people like Tom Holland recently in Dominion and things like that have been pointing out to us who are very used to the idea of crucifixion now, because it's all around us, we've had that image with us a long time as an image of hope and love and forgiveness, but that in the ancient world, it was an awful, shameful thing. And at that level, as I understood it in your book, Mike, you also make this case that this would have been a very odd thing for people to have invented, that Jesus was crucified, that the Lord of the whole universe, the Messiah, that was the way in which actually God was going to fulfill this plan. Again, it comes out of, like, this was not something that Jewish people would have expected, but yet this is what they started saying. And again, it's I suppose that criterion of embarrassment, that sort of thing. Why on earth would you make this up when it was actually such a shameful thing, arguably not good for your cause, for your leader to have died this horrible death, shameful death at the hands of the Roman overlords and so on?
Like Vicini says in The Princess Bride, inconceivable, right? Inconceivable. They could not conceive. And the pagans wouldn't either. I mean, we're not going to throw a guy on a cross and make him a religious symbol that, yeah, that's our guy. It's just literally inconceivable. So,
Paul says as much. You know, he says this is, you know,
absurd,
absurd to the Greeks, scandalous to the Jews.
Right.
So, yeah. What do you make of this general claim then, Matthew? That the crucifixion itself is not the kind of that's not the way you get a Jewish Messiah in the ancient world.
That may be true, but they couldn't avoid it really, because crucifixion happened. Lots of people were crucified. It was very public. It was pretty ghastly. You know, I would imagine that we would consider hanging quite humane in comparison to crucifixion, because it was truly unpleasant. And so you can't avoid, if you're going to have the Jesus narrative, Jesus was probably really genuinely crucified and then thrown into a pit. So you can't get that story without embracing that the crucifixion happened.
I guess the question that it leaves for me, though, is why didn't they do what all the other people who had their messianic leaders crucified, which was go home and get a new leader? Why did they suddenly start saying, oh, this crucified Messiah is in fact the Lord of the world?
And this is absolutely part of the mystery to how, and probably the answer as well at the same time, to how Christianity got off the ground. And I'm quite happy to say I don't know what genuinely happened, and I don't know how that the religion of Christianity got its feet under the table, but a religion was going to come about, because that's what humans did in that time. There were lots of religions, lots of cults, lots of sects, yeah, and Christianity isn't the only religion that's got its feet off the ground and become very large from very improbable beginnings. So what you want from me is an explanation of what happened. I don't know what happened. What I'm quite confident to say, though, is that what happened as described in the Bible, I consider extremely unlikely and extraordinarily unlikely. Even when you go just to the crucifixion bit itself, even that, while I accept that it happened, has got creeping fiction into it. We've got the darkness for 3 hours. How on earth did that happen? We've got the impossible earthquake. We've got the temple curtain being torn. And these sniff of later additions to the story. And so you've got everything that moves forward beyond that. And it's completely feasible to me that over the years that followed, later things got added. I have in my own family a tragic event that 30 years later became a story of a miracle. And so I am very deeply and painfully familiar with how something that tragic happened becomes into a miracle years later, and people believe that a miracle happened in my family when frankly it didn't. And it's painful for me to experience that, and it's painful for me to have the knowledge that there's a church here in the UK that believes that a miracle happened in my family when frankly it didn't. So I am very familiar with how a story can go from tragedy to miracle just by natural progression over time and retelling and different people getting involved in the story. So it's really easy for me to believe that the resurrection story evolved out of whatever happens next.
We'll go to a quick break and then get your response to this, Mike, because it's naturally sort of leading us into the resurrection anyway. And I wanted to speak to that as well. Uninvented is the new book by Mike DiVirgilio, and there's a link to it from today's show and, of course, to Matthew Taylor's podcast, Still Unbelievable. We're asking, are the stories of Jesus too scandalous, too unconventional, too unexpected to have been made up? We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's show, and we'll be back into the conversation on Uninvented with Mike and Matthew in a moment's time. There's another chance to hear mine and Ruth Jackson's conversation with New York's pastor to skeptics, Tim Keller. That's on The Profile this evening on Premier Christian Radio at 8 p.m. Or you can listen back on The Profile podcast. And Tim Keller is the cover story on the February edition of Premier Christianity magazine. Next week here on Unbelievable, Death to Deconstruction. That's the name of the new book by Josh Porter. He's in conversation with John Steingard on whether ex-evangelicals can reconstruct their faith. Well, Josh Porter is a punk singer turned pastor. He was a lead singer for a band called Showbread back in the day. And his book charts his own journey of reconstructing his Christian faith. So that's his book, Death to Deconstruction, Reclaiming Faithfulness as an Act of Rebellion. So he'll be in discussion on deconstruction, the Bible, the problem of evil and more with John Steingard, who you may remember joined me on a couple of occasions not long after he started to talk about his own journey of deconstruction as a former music artist with Hawk Nelson. So it's going to be an interesting one next week. Josh Porter, John Steingard joining me on the show. Now, just a quick reminder, this is your last chance as well to register for our next live show, happening this Tuesday, the 7th of February, 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific if you're joining us from the USA. Two perspectives on sexuality, gender and identity join me. Be part of the live audience. Ask your questions as well at unbelievable.live. This will be like a regular Unbelievable show where I'm joined by two different discussion partners, and you can be part of it on the night. So do look forward to seeing lots of Unbelievable listeners when we host that this coming Tuesday evening. Unbelievable.live to book your place, absolutely free. We're going to go to some of your feedback later on. Got lots of your feedback to that interesting debate on miracle healings between Craig Keener, Peter May and Josh Brown. So look out for some of that coming up in a little while. Right now, let's get into the final part of today's show. Welcome back. We've been talking about whether the Bible stories of Jesus could have been made up, or whether they have the ring of truth because of the sort of criterion of embarrassment, the fact that there wasn't a motivation for Jewish people of the time to have invented these kinds of stories about a crucified Messiah who gets raised from the dead. We've kind of have reached the resurrection, Mike, and you may want to respond to some of what Matthew had to say there about his own experience, that in his experience, you know, tragic stories can get retold until they become miraculous. I guess it does lead us into the question of the resurrection itself, which you spend some time obviously talking about, why you also believe that couldn't have been invented, why that didn't meet the expectations of Jesus's followers at the time, why, you know, it doesn't hold together that this sort of thing could have been fabricated and put together by the early followers of Jesus. So do you want to just give us a sort of summary of that and your thoughts on what Matthew had to say as well?
Yeah, well, you know, the word bias, you know, I used, and so whatever you want to say. So Matthew comes to the text, says the sun stopping, the curtain That's, so whatever you want to call it, that's a something you come to the text assuming can't happen, and therefore it's not true. So I think that's an important consideration, that these things that are not natural, like this don't just happen, the reason we believe them is because they have verisimilitude, because God exists, because we believe the Bible is God's revelation, because we believe in inspiration, right? Not that you have to, like you said earlier, Justin, you could just read that without thinking of your assumptions, but wow, do they read real. And I don't get into the theology in the book, but theologically, it's just genius, and for what everything meant. But we can't go down that rabbit hole. So the resurrection was something that of a man in the middle of history could not happen to a Jew. That just was inconceivable, because for Jews, resurrection was at the end of time. It was eschatological, and they had no conception of one man coming back from the dead, because that would make no sense to them. Because like Martha, so at Lazarus's tomb, she says, Jesus says, your brother will raise from the dead. And she goes, I know at the last day he will rise, because everybody's going to rise. All the God's people will rise from the dead in resurrected bodies. But he said, no, he's not going to die, because he believes in me, and so on. So they had no idea, and then Jesus proves it by raising Lazarus from the dead. And that, of course, is a picture of what's going to happen with him. And I think, to me, that has one of the most, that's, Lazarus is one of the most believable stories in the Bible, because Jesus is standing in front of the tomb, and he's going to raise him from back from life in a few minutes, and he cries and weeps angrily. And why would you make up a story about him solving the problem in moments and yet make him do that? That kind of response doesn't make any sense. He should be going, man, I'm raising him from the dead. No problem. You guys are all, don't cry, and he does that. And so, and then you're asking me to believe that the Jews, who had no conception of one man coming back in the middle of history, because it would contradict everything they believed theologically, that in their despair, they make that up. Yes. And then less than 50 days later, they come back and say, this Jesus rose from the dead, and he's the Lord. It just beggars belief that it was made up.
So for you, there's this strong disjunct here, Mike, between what their theological expectations would have been as Jews of the time and what they reported happened. And that if they were trying to, as it were, launch a messianic movement, this would have been a very odd way to go about it. This wouldn't have been the way you would have expected people to have done it. And for you, that as I say, gives it the ring of historical credibility, even to someone who doesn't share necessarily.
Because Messiah's come about, and they conquer the enemy. That's what the Messiah is, a king, right? He comes and he's going to take off the Romans and take them out, and he dies on a cross. And then he comes back from the dead to prove.
And then allegedly comes back from the dead. So Matthew, you've heard this before, I'm sure, this argument for
multiple the resurrection. Times. Yeah. And maybe they did expect Jesus to lead an army and to take out the Romans. And maybe they were completely disappointed. And in fact, when you read the text, that appears to be what it was. They hid away because they were afraid. And maybe what they expected isn't actually what happened, and so they were and then something happened. Maybe it was some obscure sect, because when in part of the research I've been doing for this, I tripped across the Essenes. They're not necessarily new to me, but when I read some of what the Essenes believe, there's parallels with what the Essenes believe to what I see in some of Christianity today. Bodily resurrection is one of the things that they believed, which appears to be at odds with most of the rest of the Jews at the time. So maybe it's part of their beliefs came into it. There are lots and lots of options to what may have happened. And I think one of the myths that I hear a lot from Christians about what people like myself might believe is that we believe that the story was written down in one go, invented by a small group of people. That's not at all what I believe. What my proposal into where Christianity grew from is evolved narrative over many, many years, decades, maybe even hundreds of years. The story that of my own family that I told you about earlier And that's a story that evolved over about 30 years, you know, half a lifetime. So I'm not proposing that whatever happened about the gospel narratives was somebody inventing it there and then in one weekend of hard, really, really hard work. I don't think anybody that I know suggests that in any kind of seriousness. This is something that got evolved over the retelling of many, many, many years, decades even. And I think that is far more realistic way in which this kind of happened. So when people were writing these documents and these gospels down, they were writing things down many years after the fact. One of the things that I tripped across while looking at the gospels and the narrative of the gospels and things like that is there's an obscure gospel account which never made it into canon of Jesus as a stroppy teenager apparently striking one of his friends dead because he annoyed him and then immediately raising him to life again. I don't think that there's a Christian alive today or has ever been alive who believes that that actually happened. But yet it's written down in the same period of time. And for whatever reason, people rejected that coming into canon. I understand why, but it's from the same period of time. And I would imagine there's every Christian who would read that would say, well, that's just a fiction. That's something happened. There we go. There is evidence of after the fact fictional accounts being written. Some of these fictional accounts are believed to be true, and some of them are quite rightly rejected as fiction. And that is how we get the Bible.
Yeah, Mike.
Well, I talk about Richard Baucom wrote a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, because what Matthew is basically espousing is what critical scholars have said for several hundred years, is that this is not eyewitness testimony. There's a kernel of history, and then it was made up over time. And I reject that, categorically, of course. And so Baucom talks about recollective memory, this idea that something is so dramatic that you remember it in a way that you would not remember what you had for breakfast 3 weeks ago. Right? You just, that's not important. So I use the example of, some of our lifetimes and further back, you have World War, you have Pearl Harbor for, you know, Americans and British too, but Pearl Harbor, you have Kennedy's assassination and 9/11. And I remember my wife at nine in the morning of 9/11 comes in our bedroom freaking out. And I could see her at this moment. And she's just like, planes flew into the World Trade Center, plane or whatever. It's like, go downstairs. I mean, I could see myself, and my son wasn't even born yet. And my oldest son, he's going to be 21. And you just remember these the details about that. Everyone says, I knew where I was. When John Lennon was shot, I remember where I was sitting because I'm a big Beatles fan. You just remember. And so Jesus was so radical and so different and so amazing that the memories that they had of him, it's reasonable to think this was stuck in their brain. And Jesus, I call him a rock star in the fourth chapter or whatever, that he was so popular you couldn't make him up. You couldn't just invent stories, you know, because everyone knew who Jesus was. And if you're going to make things up, and I reject what Matthew says, is that this was over decades and decades, and it was just, you know, like you somehow can't.
So there's that aspect, there's the memory side, Matthew, that obviously Mike feels it, that it's coming from a reliable eyewitness source.
But it only goes so far, though. I remember 9/11. I remember where I was working. I remember the car that I was driving at the time, or rather owned at the time, and then drove home in later that day. And I remember it was a Tuesday because Tuesday was the day of church youth group. And I, at that period in time, was a youth group leader at the church that I attended because at that point in time, I was still a Christian. So I remember those details. I remember those details quite clearly. I could not tell you everybody who came to youth group. I could probably guess half a dozen of the people who were there at youth group because some of those people are still in my Facebook friends list. But I couldn't tell you all the names. I know that we talked about the events of the day at youth group that evening, but I can't tell you exactly what I said. I can't accurately report to you the things, the details of the conversations that we had. The details that I can remember are superficial. I can't remember any of the explicit details. I couldn't tell you what clothes I was wearing, for example, or the clothes that anybody else was wearing, or what sweets were available in the tuck shop that night, or any of that kind of thing. I can only remember some of the details, and the ones that would make for a good autobiography of that point in my life. I can't tell you those details because I can't remember the conversations that I had.
It's kind of apples and oranges, though, because, well, it is, because we're talking about first century Jewish culture and memory and memorizing in a you know, a culture where most people didn't read and couldn't read. And they were with Jesus for 3 years. So my analogy breaks down at that point, like you rightly point out. But the point is that people in that time had incredible memories and remembered things purposefully. And here was Jesus teaching them, and they were experiencing Jesus. And so,
you see, that's another claim that fails a fact check. When I've done searching on this kind of thing and searching for quality of memory, and psychologists and neurologists and people who talk about this kind of thing, I don't find anybody who knows about how the human brain works affirming that as a true fact. They all say the same thing, that the memory fades with the retelling the same as today as it did 2,000 years
ago. And that's based on your assumption?
No, it's based. I agree with that's not my assumption. This is based on what I've read of what other people who know about this kind of thing
right,
have said.
Right. So, but again, let's go back to something. I believe it's not merely a human document, and you do. So we're always going to collide, right? Because I believe
there's always, obviously, you are coming from different, you know, standpoints on that front. I guess we're trying to find those bits where you can kind of objectively agree on some of these historical elements and
yes,
whether
see,
or
I'm
not
assuming
it pushes
it's a human document. I'm looking at, like I said earlier, the transmission of the document, the way the documents work, looks exactly the same as every other document that we know is a human document. So that's why I've reached my conclusion. I haven't come to this conversation saying, oh, the Bible is definitely human. I'm saying, if it's not human, it has some supernatural assistance, what would I expect to see? Would I expect there to be something different to other human documents? And the answer is no, I don't see anything different. Therefore, I apply the same.
I mean, just coming back to that whole question of embellishment and the stories finally taking the shape they did after many years and so on that Matthew said there. I mean, we're not necessarily just drawing on the Gospels, that you also talk obviously little in the book about other New Testament documents, the letters of Paul and so on. And again, I've heard other scholars talk about the fact that it seems difficult for there to have been this telephone game and change over time when you have got Paul affirming the essential facts of the crucifixion and resurrection in a kind of liturgical, you know, creedal form in 1 Corinthians 13, which seems to go back to beyond just when Paul was writing, to sort of quite close to the events of the time. And you just wanted your commentary on whether that as well feeds into this, what you write about in Uninvented.
Absolutely. So Luke is a great example. As a historian, when you read Luke, the last thing it reads is like a telephone game. And in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist book, they talk about, I don't know, it's like 83 different details, historical and archaeological, that Luke nails, just gets it right on. And yet, I'm to believe that the miracle stuff, he just kind of made it up. I can't believe that. You know, if he is such a careful, I think I call him Luke the careful chronicler. If he is so careful about details, and he was with Paul.
Could you give an example of one of those details?
Oh, no, not off the top. Okay. Well, so the currents of the ports when they were sailing in the, you know, where they went, and with the currents, westerly winds, and, you know, I have them in here, some of them anyway, and you could read that in I Don't Have Any Faith to Be an Atheist, but they are archaeological, who the names were of the person who was, you know. I don't have that.
So off the top of your head, you haven't got that right. But but there are, yes, other, as I've pointed out, that Luke obviously sets his gospel and Acts within a, evidently, you know, historical, you know, verifiably, you know, events and people and that kind of thing. I mean, Matthew, does that make any difference for you? The fact that there is appears to be a sort of historical settings seem to match up and so on.
Fictional stories very often involve accurate descriptions of physical settings. So that on its own doesn't get me there. It certainly gives an excuse to look into more detail into what is being said. But describing the reality of the physical world accurately doesn't automatically mean that the things that I can't confirm are also true, but it certainly gives a reason to look into it more in more detail and to examine it in more detail.
It's more credible, at least, than if they'd got that wrong. Let's yes, put it that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they can't even get physical details right, then there's definitely no reason to think of anything else more seriously. But on the subject of that and creeping narrative, and we did promise a little bit about the resurrection. I think one of the most problematic parts of the resurrection for me is that the morning after story, the women coming to the tomb, which is told in all four of the Gospels. And there are many, many problems for me in that story. The first one which I came across when I was looking into it in more detail is this whole thing about anointing the body. Because when I was reading about the customs of anointing the body is normally anointed before it's wrapped and before it's buried. And what we've got is this narrative device to get the women to the tomb after the tomb's been sealed by a stone, after the body has apparently been wrapped in clothes, to allegedly anoint the body. But this is out of order, and we're talking about getting details right. This is the detail that seems to be fundamentally wrong. But then as you read the story more and compare the four Gospels, there are massive differences in detail what's going on. Now, is it the women on their own, or is it one Mary or two Marys? Are there men accompanying the women to the tomb? Is there an angel? Is there not an angel? Is it two angels? Did Jesus talk with Mary in the garden or as Mary was leaving the garden? So we're talking about getting believable details right. These are potentially believable details which they can't agree on, which are fundamentally wrong, which are so wrong they can't be harmonized. And that
actually
gives me a problem for believing other bits.
Right, but nobody's ever said that you're going to have... The fact that they differ makes them more believable to me. And this has been an argument that Christian scholars have made for a long time. So you're looking at, if it has to be like, what is it, Memorex? It has to be, if you were taking a movie, this is what the facts would be. And that's not what Christians claim biblical inspiration is about, right? And there's different reasons that these can be harmonized in some ways and so on. But that's beyond the scope of what we're talking about.
But it goes
about.
Well beyond that, though, because in one of them, the women didn't say anything, and in another point, the women did say something.
But there are
reasons
for that.
That is a fundamental problem. This isn't just memory difficulty. This is a fundamental transmission.
There's reasons for that. We can argue for a long time about that, but we can't here.
I mean, it's interesting. You say that you see the fact that women go to put the spices on the body on the morning.
There's a reason for that,
I mean, I've yes. Under normal circumstances, we can assume that would have all taken place. Is it not plausible, Matthew, that the fact that this crucifixion happened on the Friday, just as Passover was happening, and therefore that did make it difficult for all of the rites to be undertaken, that it makes sense in that context for them to have to come back and do something additional stuff to the body? Is that not a kind of reasonable understanding of the text, Matthew?
Potentially, but then you've also got this character, Joseph of Arimathea, who asked for the body so he could put it in the tomb. So you've got a period there where the proper anointing could have been done.
And it's just potentially not if they were just on the verge of Sabbath happening. And
right, because then
Jews would then be able to...
In Deuteronomy, it's the curse. The whole land would be cursed if he's left on the tree when the sun goes down. So, you know, they were in a hurry there. So what you say could be true. Yeah, that seems like but to me, it's more plausible to see that disparity of their customs.
It strikes me that in some of these cases, all I'm saying, Matthew, is there's a sort of glass half empty and glass half full approach. You could either say, oh, they kind of invented that bit of the story to get the women there, or the glass half full approach is that seems historically plausible, that's just the way it happened. You know, I wonder how you do kind of whether the mindset we come to the text with sort of...
On its own, yes, maybe. But once you start looking at the bigger picture story, and, you know, we've heard already in this conversation about, you know, things meeting what the Jews expected, you know, in terms of Jews wouldn't make things up or applying to Jew. And now suddenly we've got something that steps out of the way Jews would do things. And it's supposed to be acceptable. So it's this inconsistency of the flow. And I would expect a greater consistency of the flow.
Well, it's been fascinating. Thank you both for the time that we've spent going back and forth on this. If you want, obviously, the full story, we've only touched on some of the details that Mike brings out in this book, Uninvented, you can, of course, go and get hold of it. It's available at his website, mikedevergilio.com. There's a link with today's show. If you want more from Matthew and his friends on the Still Unbelievable podcast, or indeed some of the books and other articles they've written, there's a link from today's show. Reasonpress.net will also get you a lot of that as well. Sorry we haven't had more time. There's a lot more we could have covered, but it's been a real pleasure having you both on the show. Matthew and Mike, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for being gracious, Mike.
Look forward to hearing what you made of this one. Do get in touch on email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or via our social media at UnbelievableFE for our Twitter account, facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable to find us on Facebook. And lots of people leave their comments, of course, in the comments on the YouTube video as well each week. So we've had lots of your feedback, actually, by all of those methods to the recent debate on miracle healing. I'll tell you about that in a moment's time. Just want to say, though, if you enjoy Unbelievable, well, you'll enjoy next week's show. You'll also enjoy some of the other stuff coming up, including that live show I've already mentioned. Stephen Meyer also coming back on the show in February as well to talk about order in the cosmos. Got a really interesting show coming up with him, with another professor of science, and that's Salim Ali. So look out for that. Loads of great stuff as well, of course, on our other podcast from Premier Unbelievable on Ask NT Wright Anything this past week, Making Sense of Old Testament Violence. Tom responded to listener questions on Andy Stanley's comments about unhitching Christianity from the Old Testament, the historicity of Exodus, and the way that Greg Boyd interprets violent portraits of God in the crucifixion of the warrior God. So you can go and listen to that at the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast. On Matters of Life and Death with John and Tim Wyatt, they're talking about cryptocurrency at the moment, Bitcoin, warehouses of computers solving maths puzzles, the dot-com bubble, and FOMO, fear of missing out. On the C.S. Lewis podcast, it's the fourth episode of a series focusing on McGrath's book, C.S. Lewis, A Life, Ruth Jackson diving into Lewis's first years at Oxford, The Making of an Oxford Don, and exploring the nature of his complicated relationship with Mrs. Moore. We're also running on the C.S. Lewis podcast at the moment a chance to win one of 15 copies of Alistair McGrath's seminal biography. In fact, just registering for our newsletter at the website puts you automatically into the draw for that. That's, again, premierunbelievable.com. And over on our Unapologetic, Ruth's also been talking to journalist Lauren Windle about her story of getting sober from alcohol and cocaine, and how she encountered the God who changed her life. So loads of great content, as ever, across all of our podcasts, premierunbelievable.com to discover them. As ever, many articles being written and released from week to week. This last week, Bethel McGrew wrote for us about why, when the Church of England blesses gay marriage, it signs its own death certificate. And Steve Schramm explores young earth creationism, old earth creationism, intelligent design and theistic evolution, four different perspectives on creation and evolution. So just a couple of the things that you can go and read and check out at premierunbelievable.com. Just want to also give a shout out to our friends over at the London Unbelievable Christian and Skeptics Discussion Group. They've got another live meeting happening in London on Monday the 13th of February, 7 p.m. Their special guest will be Josh Parikh, talking about a tumultuous period in apologetics. Josh, of course, has been a guest on The Unbelievable Show and has a long career in apologetics and philosophy of religion, having studied at Oxford. Now, as a Christian, deeply sympathetic to the apologetics movement, he's well placed to take a step back and look at the current trends, which he considers is going through a tumultuous period. He'll be using, as an example, responses by some Christian thinkers to ethical and historical issues surrounding the Old Testament narratives of the flood and conquest of Canaan, etc. So if you want to be there to listen to Josh and to join the discussions between the Christians and skeptics who gather there, it's, as usual, happening at the Cock Tavern near King's Cross and Euston Stations, 7 p.m. Monday the 13th of February. You want more info, look it up at meetup.com. You're looking for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. So there you go. Always good to give a shout out to that group. Doesn't officially belong to Unbelievable, but it's great to know that it's happening. Let's go to some of your feedback. And as I said, lots of interesting response to the Miracle Healing Show. Craig Keener, Peter May, and Josh Brown joined me last week. Peter May, a Christian, a retired GP, but who's very skeptical of miracle healing claims. And he did not mince his words when it came to the way he interacted with Josh Brown and Craig Keener, who were presenting medical evidence of healings. Here's how some of you reacted on Twitter. Cody said, "I've no doubt that God still does miracles. I have seen dangerous fevers immediately drop to normal. I had a fractured arm that healed instantly. I've seen a woman nearly deaf, suddenly able to hear everything. I've seen the dead raised." David says, "Do yourself a favor and watch this episode. Global MRI's Joshua Brown demonstrated well beyond a reasonable doubt, despite very vigorous skepticism from Peter May, that naturalistic explanations won't do." Micah said, "This is Justin hosting a discussion with Craig Keener and two medical doctors on miracle claims. Maybe I'm biased, but Dr. May seemed to adopt a standard of evidence that is impossible to meet. What do you think?" And that was sort of where a lot of other people were kind of concentrating their comments as well. Gene said, "I thought a lot of patience was exercised in this episode. I'm sure whatever evidence was put forward, Peter would have argued against it. I'm convinced there are some people who will not believe a miracle has taken place, even when the evidence is profound. The other participants did so well, I would have lost my cool with him," says Gene. Eric, who's a friend of the show, Eric Strandless, regularly blogs for us, says, "I'm just sending in some thoughts on that show. As an intensive care physician myself, I listened with interest to the show on miracles. I have seen some surprising and remarkable healings in my career, but being a bit of a skeptic, I have hesitated calling them miracles and instead attributed them to misdiagnoses, spontaneous remissions, or unusual responses to intensive care. I do, however, believe miracles occur. Peter May, on the other hand, despite some unusual health-related experience, doesn't believe we have good evidence for miracles. Short of seeing a withered limb restored or a crooked back straightened, he remains sceptical. While Peter's desire is not to deny the possibility of miracles, he admirably wants to make sure that Christians are meticulous when they employ them as arguments for the truth of their faith and to prevent them from being carelessly used to give people false hopes of good health." The common explanations he uses for apparent miraculous healing is the widely accepted yet poorly understood idea of psychosomatic illness, which the guest defined as a functional deficit without any identifiable organic cause. However, attributing perceived healings to a psychosomatic process is itself problematic because to do so, one must dabble in the dark art of consciousness and accuse the immaterial mind of casting a spell on the physical body. While the show concentrated on physical healings, perhaps the bigger miracle is how our immaterial thoughts can facilitate physiological changes. Psychosomatic illness raises a profound question. Why would a purely materialistic evolutionary process naturally select for a state of mind whereby it could deceive itself? Survival of the fittest would seem to be in big trouble if we have the unfortunate ability to believe we need a wheelchair when a tiger is charging straight at us. You would think that matter in motion wouldn't select for a mental state that stops itself dead in its tracks. By invoking the power of the mind, he inadvertently opens up another mysterious can of worms by raising the hard problem of consciousness. The hard evidence he wants for physical healings is overshadowed by an appeal to the miracle of consciousness. If psychosomatic illness is a real phenomenon, then the mind is a very powerful thing indeed, and for one intrigued by its power, it is a small step to consider one whose thoughts are higher than our own. Thanks, Eric. Of course, Peter May, I don't think, would have a problem with the idea of the consciousness that is devolves, as it were, from the mind of God. As a Christian, he just obviously takes a strong line on whether any miracles are actually happening in our day and age. Graham from Whitstable Skeptics says, "First of all, I sympathised with Peter as he had to explain why he accepted biblical miracles with far less evidence than Craig and Joshua provided. But as a materialist, I agreed with his sceptical views on modern miracle claims. Like him, I'm astonished that the examples given were the best they could offer. The digestive tract, one lacked the medical evidence that the problem actually existed in the first place, and the sight loss case relied on testimony that was damaged to the eye rather than physical evidence. The only physical evidence was that there was no longer a problem. I don't want to doubt personal evidence, but you would have thought with the thousands of miracles that are reported to have happened, you would have at least 100 or so with irrefutable evidence, with x-rays, MRI scans, blood tests, etc. from before and after the miracle. Plus, if Craig and Joshua have this evidence from respected specialists, why don't they specialists seek to publish it in a medical journal rather than relying on Craig and Joshua?" Thank you very much, Graham. Glad you enjoyed that. Logan's an ex-Christian who gets in touch to say, I found the latest episode on miracle healings an interesting one, not least because I, as a non-Christian, found myself to be less skeptical than one of the Christian guests. I remember at Bible college finding cessationism to be an odd position, and I suppose I still do. When it comes to miracles, I take a fairly agnostic position. I've never seen any obvious healings myself, but having been part of charismatic church circles for so long, I've heard a number of stories. I do have a moderately sceptical approach to the stories, which I think is warranted in a number of scenarios. I find a lot of smaller healings could be explained psychologically, or I've even heard stories of church leaders in Africa who pay people to turn up to a service in a wheelchair and then be quote-unquote healed on stage, as it draws a crowd and endows them with extra authority. Nonetheless, I've also heard stories of the supernatural which I can't really explain, nor do I think it's necessarily my place to do so. Those presented by Joshua on the show seem to be of that type, and it was a little painful hearing Peter clutch at straws and psychosomatic explanations. I suppose the reason that healing stories haven't kept me fully in the faith, they were one of the last things I held on to the hope of before leaving, it felt a bit like having divine medical insurance, is that they don't hit quite the same way when you're not a direct witness or know the individuals personally. They often remain stories. That level of detachment often means the questions come shortly after and have more of a hold. Why was that person healed and not this other? Why did God allow them to suffer for so many years before healing them, etc.? In my current position, I can only rejoice that someone has been freed from whatever condition they were in and admit that I haven't the foggiest what went on. There are more things in heaven and earth than can be dreamt of in your philosophy, to quote Shakespeare. Anyway, thanks as ever for the show. Keep up the good work. Good to hear from you, Logan. Great to know that you're listening. Logan's been a previous guest on the show in the past. Maggie says, thanks for all the stimulating and informative podcast. Just listen to the show on miracle healings. I want to say well done to you, Joshua, and Craig for showing such patience with Peter May. He came across as an impossible man. I would have loved to ask him why, as a Christian, can he not give glory to God for his work without doubting and looking for the negative in everything God has done? Also, why can he not accept the John 14, verse 12, which says, very truly I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these, because I am going to the Father. Also, why does he not recognize there's a clear link between faith and the power to do miracles, according to Mark 6, verse 5, where it says, he could not do any miracles there, except lay his hand on a few sick people and heal them. And finally, I find it insulting that he decries people's real suffering by dismissing things as psychosomatic. As an early years teacher, I find that a test of whether you understand something properly is whether you can explain it simply. It's a cop-out to say you can write a book on something, but not explain it simply. Thanks for your work. Thanks, Maggie. Always good to hear from lots of listeners. Let's squeeze one more in. Ruth in New Jersey says, can't tell you how much I appreciate you and the wonderful variety of shows you produce. I listen to almost all of them. Thank you. Just finished listening to Miracle Healing, Does It Happen Today? And I must say, Joshua Brown's calmness and patience throughout the show was nothing short of miraculous. Kudos to Joshua. In fairness to Peter May, I do appreciate his concern that persons will not seek proper medical care if they rely on healers. But what truly vexed me about Peter's rebuttals to the evidence was his argument that if Brown had written a well-supported account of miraculous healing, a peer-reviewed, reputable scientific or medical journal would have accepted and published it. Nothing could be further from the truth. It takes quite a bit of naivety to believe that. Sadly, any skeptic listening to this podcast could use such criticism as an excuse to turn away from the facts that Craig and Brown present. What a loss. As Brown so well explained, naturalism rules the journals, as exemplified by the persecution Richard Sternberger received when he dared to publish an article by Stephen Meyer in the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington. As Brown said, the journals don't want to let a divine foot in the door, not even a divine little toe. Keep up the great discussions, Justin. Hope to meet you someday on this side of the pond. Thanks, Ruth. Great to hear from you and everyone else who got in touch with all of those responses to last week's show. If you've got more that you'd like to add, feel free to email them in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You mentioned Stephen Meyer there, Ruth. As I said earlier, he's actually joining us on a show in the not-too-distant future. We've got lots of great content coming your way on Unbelievable, including, of course, that live show. Final chance to register for that, Tuesday the 7th of February, unbelievable.live. Register there. You can join us this Tuesday as we talk about sexuality, gender and identity with my two guests, Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell. So thanks for being with us this week. Let me tell you what's coming up. On next week's show, Death to Deconstruction, Josh Porter and John Steingard on whether ex-evangelicals can reconstruct their faith. Punk singer turned pastor Josh Porter charts his own journey of reconstructing his Christian faith in the book Death to Deconstruction, Reclaiming Faithfulness as an Act of Rebellion. And he discusses deconstruction, the Bible, the problem of evil, and much more with John Steingard, returning to the show, former lead singer of Hawk Nelson, who underwent his own journey of deconstruction back in 2020. Be another interesting conversation for you. Same time next week. For now, God bless.